pals o' mine. A go-to exercise for me is walking 5.5 miles a few days a week alongside the American River Bike Trail. It's over 20 miles long and is not only popular with cyclists, but also walkers and runners, as there are wide areas alongside the trail. Horse trails are available as well, all of which follow the American River. It's lovely. Anyway, as a regular, so to speak, I witness some interesting people. On the bike path itself, I've seen unicycles and a couple riding a cart pulled by two llamas. A ranger told them it was not allowed. There's a cyclist I see regularly who yells, "Woohoo!" each time he passes someone. And then there is the brief snippet of conversation I overheard as one cyclist asked another as they flew by me, "What did you do with the body?" Yesterday, a bicyclist rode past calling out, "Grrr, grrr." That was a new one. We're in rattlesnake season now, and I often see them straightened out, sunning alongside the trail. One time, there was a rattler coiled up dead center in the bike path. I knew it was not going to end well for either the rattler or the cyclist, and I didn't stick around to see how it played out. Weekly exercises can be quite an adventure, better than the gym. John Wood experienced quite a different adventure during a volunteer gig on the Hawaiian Chieftain, a 1988 replica of an old packet ship designed for cargo trade among the Hawaiian Islands.
Well, since you weren't during stormy winter seas, it was probably fairly steady, I would imagine, walking up and down the...
By all accounts, it was a pleasure cruise, given what Captain J.B., John Morrison, had to say. But that did mean 8 to 12-foot seas breaking over the forward bow and a ship that seemed to have a variable pivot point. That meant sideways, forward, and up and down. So it was an interesting voyage.
How long did it take you to get your sea legs?
I pretty much had them instinctively automatic. I think the sea stuff is DNA to me because of my family heritage back, my marine family heritage back on Cape Cod. It's never challenged me. Seasickness, I mean, there were a few close calls, but seasickness or sea legs, people ask me that. When you got off the boat, did it take you a while to get your sea legs? I didn't even think twice about it.
For some people, it's just getting off the treadmill. They have to get their balance.
I've eaten treadmill, so that, you know, I can understand that one.
So that was a pretty good trade to do volunteer on the... It was a clipper?
A coastal packet trader. It's designed to replicate a type of ship that rounded the horn back when the United States was a fledgling country, trade in the harbors, the unimproved small harbors that a deep draft schooner could not navigate. And since the country was new and there was no, let's say, Army Corps of Engineers digging out harbors, they needed these type of ships to ferry goods from the communities along the western seaboard out to the real big clipper ships that carried it off to China.
Do the crew, the permanent crew, the actual working crew, do they perform reenactments of sorts for those that pay for the trips?
Actually, the core community is addressed are schools in the area. So what they do is they have a program that usually, if the harbor is safe, includes a sail out into the ocean, and then they have various stations, for example, trade, and it talks about how the trade was affected along the West Coast. Then they have the life of a sailor from an officer's point of view, and then from a sailor's point of view. And then they have other stations like things that sailors might have done, like tie knots. So the kids get to move about these different stations and get immersed in various characters in character, sharing the history. I put on what we call the funnies, very ill-fitting clothes that were somewhere between shabby and shabby chic for the period, and basically learned the history and then delivered it to the kids in as an animated fashion as I could. Did I say that right?
Animated.
Yeah. In animated, yes. I'm good at making up words.
It was 7 days? That was the length of the trip?
Yeah. You know, originally I tried to bypass it. It was 192 to ride from San Francisco, Pier 40, to Fort Bragg. And I was like, wow, that's a great blogging opportunity. I can be a passenger and, you know, master commander myself aboard the sailing ship. When I went to the website, it was sold out. Now, I had been in contact with them before that to see if I could get on board and do some different media, and that didn't so much work out. So once I realized the boat was sold out, I went back to the website, and lo and behold, they were shorthanded. And so I said, hey, I'll just volunteer. You know, let me ride the boat. And I expected a similar agenda to the passengers. You know, I'd volunteer, scrub some dishes, take the day and a half trip, and then get on a bus and come back home. Well, when the paperwork arrived, it was like, well, you're going to be on board until next Saturday. And I cleared that through the household. And the household said, fine. And so I was a crew member for a full 7 days, although the sail part was done in under 30 hours.
So it was mostly you're anchored offshore.
Correct, in Noyo Harbor.
A lot of maintenance, I would imagine, as most water vessels.
Chores. A sailor's life is not done. I was assigned duties just like any other crew or deckhand on that boat, from literally the minute I got on Sunday night till I got off on Saturday morning. I did chores, stood watch, washed, polished brass, taught the kids, cleaned the head, galley duty. And some of the days were long. Galley duty day starts with raising the flag and ends with dropping the flag at sunset. Actually, it ends with turning the generators off on the boat at 10 a.m. so it can go to shore power. So that was a 14-hour day.
Appreciate your ancestors, huh?
Absolutely, because there are some moments when you're out there doing this that make you appreciate just how dangerous it is to be on a small craft out in the ocean. And we were within 3 miles of the coast the whole time.
The vulnerability.
There was a few moments that were just darn scary. But then there were some moments that were just like, wow, even if I was in my life jacket, floating off the boat, watching it sail away into the fog, I would say, that was cool. Glug, 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 glug.
You got to have your glug.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's one of the duties was watch, which basically are assigned by blocks of time. I was on watch C. Our duty was 12 to 4, and that's 12 to 4 p.m., 12 to 4 a.m. You are basically now in charge of this ship and all aboard their safety. And you're not only making sure that there's nothing looming in the fog that's going to run over you, you're also checking the engines every hour and making sure all the passengers are in the bunk. You don't want somebody that gets up in the middle of the night and says, wow, a lovely view here, and all of a sudden is washed overboard and you don't find out for 4 hours. The conditions for the 12 to 4 a.m. watch were rough seas. We were coming upon Point Arena and the ocean there is quite confused. And it was what? Fog visibility of about a mile. Ocean was rough, confused seas, what they call the sea state was 12-foot seas from one direction and 3 foot from another direction. There was a time when I was walking between the galley and the quarter deck where I said, wow, if I slipped into that, right over on the other side of that rail, just 3 feet away in my galoshes, waders, and full fowlies, even if they could spin this on a dime, I would be in deep ocean.
And what are fowlies?
Fowlies are your rain gear. Even if it is not raining, which it did not rain, that boat and those type of boats tend to be awash from one end to the other. The waves break over the bow, and on that particular boat, if the right wave breaks, it hits the galley and flings itself all the way over to the helm station. So people in the main deck, the lowest part of the deck, if you can imagine, like a pirate ship, where you have the very raised back deck that steps down to another deck, and then there's steps down to the main deck, and then it steps up to the foredeck, which is the front of the ship, kind of like a multi-level condo, floating condo. That's a lot of wave, and you get a lot wet. So you're wearing fowlies, sea boots, pants, and a raincoat and a hat. And then you have to stay warm without sweating underneath that. So you don't want to get wet from the outside in or the inside out because it's also cold out there.
Yes, a wee bit chilly.
Just a tad chilly. When we're slashing and sloshing through the waves and they're busting over, you're trying to stay dry, stay on the deck, do your duties, make sure the ship is safe. And in the case of the watch, checking engines, checking generators, checking belts, checking bilges, checking passengers, doing your chores. And then, of course, plotting course. Watching, you're going in the right direction. There's a big wheel back there that you are attempting to follow a course on the compass while watching also your GPS and your radar. It's pretty heavy from a volunteer's standpoint.
So what experience did you have as a watchman?
Well, the first one was very cool. I call it my master and commander's moment. We were late leaving Pier 40 because we had a hydraulic leak. We were going to leave the harbor, San Francisco, with the Lady Washington, which is a sister ship. She's a little bit taller. And we could not because of this hydraulic leak. We left and we're running up the coast and we run into some fog. We are much faster. The Hawaiian Chieftain is the ship I was on, and she's much faster due to her shallow draft than the Lady Washington, which is 18 feet of boat underneath the waterline and a keel. And at some point, we were off the Sonoma coast, and there was fog, and we were looking for the Lady Washington to cross our bow because she was coming in from being on the outside of a track and subject to more wind. So she wasn't making very good headway. So we're all standing on deck looking. Passengers, my watch was on watch at that time. And I'm on the starboard or the right side of the boat, and I'm scanning for everything from whales to ships, but in this case, the Lady Washington. And it's foggy. It's like just everywhere it's fog. All you see is the water and the fog. And the water, the angle of the water changes all the time because you're going up, down, sideways, and twisting at the same time. And I saw a shadow appear in the fog off our starboard bow. We call it one point off the starboard bow. And right as I was getting ready to say, she pops out the fog. Either the fog lifted or she popped out the fog. And all of a sudden, against this gray background was this large two-masted sailing vessel. And right as I said, Lady Washington, one point off the starboard bow, the fog creeped in on her and shut her down. And that was it. But it reminded me of that first scene in Masters and Commander where the guy is going, I think I saw the bad guys. And he's having the discussion, and then the captain comes up and they beat the quarters, which is like battle stations. And if you've seen that movie, you know what it means. And that was just like, I was the one that saw the ship, and it was a cool visual. I could not take the picture fast enough because I'm trying to hold on for dear life. But to see this, what looks like a ghost ship, pop out of the fog just ahead about a mile and a half and then go back in. You know, it's all those pirate movies.
Very dramatic.
Yeah, all those Flying Dutchman movies. You know, all the Pirates of the Caribbean, all wrapped into this moment you're actually having. And that's what was really cool about it.
Very cool.
So that was one of two good moments. I will share the other one if you'd like. It also happened on the watch too, but it was the morning watch because many folks were very ill on the boat. I basically did not have my dinner meal, so I'd be up and ready if the expected weather had made the sea even rougher, and it was rougher. And now it's like 2 a.m. We're coming up on Point Arena, and the moon was basically lighting up the fog to cause it to be kind of iridescent. So you could see the fog to the ocean when the fog was thin. So that was kind of cool in itself. The water breaking around the bow of the ship, the foam was like silver. It was just like, we're here. And you could see that, and then the rest is kind of black. And we're kind of trucking up looking for this mysterious radar contact that's on our radar and blowing the foghorn every 90 seconds. My thumb has foghornitis on it. And we're doing the same watch thing. I'm in the same position. And then I started to notice the stars break. And when I noticed the stars break for a second, I looked down and I thought I saw little flashes of light in the ocean, just little blinks of light in the ocean. And then the fog came back in and it got darker again. And then it was clear. It was those little green, glowy, bioluminescent creatures.
Yes.
As we were breaking through the water, they were just like banging like little twinkling stars all over the place. And then further out, you could see just like areas of the ocean just kind of go glow in green. It's like poof, poof. It was very cool because you're just looking at these things swirl in the wake of the boat or the bow spray. And it wasn't a lot. Not as much as they told me they've experienced, but it was definitely very cool to see the little, I mean, they're bright fluorescent green. Some were like dots, some were like strings, some looked like little communities, like, hey, we're over here, blink, no, nah. So that was the other cool moment under watch.
One of those moments that you can't quite describe the emotion, the feeling behind it.
Yeah, because at the same time, you're basically terrified that you are in this foggy environment. There's another ship out there somewhere that you can kind of see on radar that basically just passed you, and you never saw it or even heard its foghorn. And you don't want to have an incident out there, especially when you have, I think at that time, you have 14 people below deck sleeping.
What were the sleeping quarters like?
Think of one of those camp cabins, but it pitches all over the place. Basically, the Hawaiian Chieftain is about 65 footer, and what you have are three sleeping areas. You have under the foredeck where the office officers sleep. They have larger berths. There's four berths right in front of what is the engine room and the galley. I was in the main compartment where the passengers and the rest of the crew were, which was 12 bunks in what would be the main hold. If there wasn't bunks, it would have been cargo there if this had been a cargo ship. And then the captain has his private quarters that are adjacent to our quarters. So basically had a small bunk with a little net that you could pull up if you wanted to make sure you didn't get pitched out. But the way they're designed, at least mine was, is that I could stick my head in an area. It was almost like a box at one end. Don't get up too soon. It was functional.
Don't get up too soon?
Yeah, because your head is right there. Plus, they're going to wake you up when it's time to do watch, and you need to be alert. So being up too soon, thinking about going out and looking all day on the over the bow and having those Titanic moments, that's fantasy. I literally spent most of my time when I wasn't on watch after we got comfortable relaxing in my bunk or sleeping, because standing on a boat is exercise by itself.
That's what I was thinking, yeah.
They say it's about 6,500 calories just to maintain your balance and stand on a boat and function on a vessel like that. Sailors can burn 6,500 calories a day. So forget the gym. Sign aboard a sailing vessel.
So I'm sure you got to know some of the permanent crew,
mm-hmm.
or quasi-permanent. I'm wondering, did they share with you turnovers? Is this something that some of the crew are just permanent all year round? Do some just come certain seasons in and out?
You know, it's kind of like a mix of the carny gypsy life and then a core team. On this voyage, we had just picked up Captain Morrison, who was coming back. He just replaced another captain. They have, let's say, like a pool of captains, a pool of engineers, and they try to pull from these people to crew the boats up. We had a captain in training, a first officer, a couple of engineers, and then one of the gentlemen that came on in San Francisco was also a member of the board, or what they call it. It's called Gray's Historical Harbor out of Aberdeen, Washington. So he was also a deckhand, and he worked the ship. And a lot of these folks had different positions. For example, many of them had worked in the galley. The person who's cooking is dedicated galley person. Let's just say the boatswain was this young lady named Daisy, and it was amazing to see the kids that were on the boat look up. Is that a girl way up there? And Daisy is climbing this rigging and stringing new lines and fixing things. And she was stout, but yet very feminine. You know, she was in that rigging like without hesitation, and she knew, because these ships, you know, there's no buttons to drop the sails when you're sailing. And we were under diesel going north, by the way. But when you drop the sails, people climb up the shrouds and undo the gaskets, which are the ropes that tie the sails to the yard arms, and when it's time to put the sails up, somebody has to climb up there and gather the sails up and tie them up against the yard arms, which are the horizontal bars that the square rigged sails hang off of. One of the engineers, Myron, he's headed to San Francisco State to work on his master's after this sail. But a couple of other ones, they say, I'm going to go to home, get in my car, and just do anything but the ocean for a few weeks. Then they will get back on. So there had been people that had been serving on the ships from 10 years to, let's say, 1 year. And then there was another volunteer, but he was on the two-week program, so he'd get his paper so that he could come in as a paid crew.
Was there any commonalities of stories?
Yeah, I think most of the commonalities was the love for sailing, the love for the ships, and even Captain Morrison didn't really have a permanent base. They were living like sailors lived. You know, when they were on the ship, they were on the ship. When they were not on the ship, they were somewhere else. Somewhere else wasn't an address, per se. You know, they had friends, or they had community places where they hung out, or family, but they really were
born under a wandering star,
pretty much. You know, born with a sextant in their hand, and they would share assignments because there's the two boats. They share crew. One minute you might be sailing on the Lady Washington, the next minute you might be crewing on the Hawaiian Chieftain. They both were on the same program, and when the ships were, for example, in Redwood City three or four weeks ago, they sailed together, and they have adventure sails and battle sails to augment the public in between the children's programs. But the main core program is education for the children. When they come to Sacramento, the Hawaiian Chieftain comes to Sacramento. They do basically 2 months worth of programs for the local schools, and they come in by the busload and rotate on the ship. And that really is the core program of the organization and the boats.
What were some of the questions kids asked you?
We were working in a pretty tight frame. And you know kids. Some of the questions are, you know, what's that furry thing hanging on the wall? They were interested in the surroundings, you know. So there's all kinds of art and trinkets on the walls, for example, in the main cabin or the aft cabin of the Hawaiian Chieftain. So you're trying to keep on track with this educational program. You don't want to whoop out the duct tape. shape. And so what they're asking you stuff like, what do you eat? And do you wear those clothes all the time? And have you ever seen a whale? They're really kind of kid questions. We dealt with a lot of first graders and then some homeschool kids that had a variety of ages. So there was a lot of different questions. But it was interesting what they knew, regardless of their age, about things like sea otters or the indigenous tribes that used to be very populous along California's north coast. It was fun to interact with them.
That's what I would think.
Yeah, it was. There were challenges as well, because you see that there is a diverse population up, for example, in the Mendocino County area in particular. So you're basically talking a program that might not be all that pretty for some of the children's previous generations, you know, if you were looking at it in the big picture. And their parents are with them too, and you feel kind of under the microscope, because everybody, I mean, it was a big thing for Fort Bragg area, for Hawaiian Chieftain to come in. They greeted us. They were so supportive. The boat tours were swamped. They appreciated, most of them, the fact that we didn't do any day sails, because the harbor was a challenge getting in and out of that Anoio Harbor. But they came down and supported the programs. They brought their kids. Some came every day we were out there and just stood on the wharf above and just shouted questions. The adults had lots of questions, you know, about the ship.
Any questions that you didn't see coming that were kind of out of left field?
No, most of them, because the name is Hawaiian Chieftain, thought, when are you going back to Hawaii? And that boat hasn't been to Hawaii since 1991. It works between Canada and San Diego. It was built in Hawaii, Lahaina, but doesn't really sail there anymore. And it's really not licensed. It's licensed for coastal sailing. But most of the folks immediately assumed, Hawaiian Chieftain, you came from Hawaii. I said, well, no, San Francisco. But no, it was an awesome experience, because the people up there in Mendocino County were really supportive, made it special to get off of that boat on the dock there, just have people appreciate in voice that the ship was even there.
Did you have any visitors on board that were dressed in pirate attire?
There was a couple of kids that had their Halloween stuff on, but for the most part, we are not pirates. Just let me make that clear. We're honest merchants, I say.
Well, I'm aware of that, but you also know there's a group of adults that do everything pirate-ish. They talk in piratese, and I did hear about a group that wanted to do that, about 20, 25 of them that wanted to get on board just because it would be fun visually, but as you say, it was sold out.
Yeah, well, they only carry 6 passengers when they're on those type of environments. Now, when I visited the ship in Redwood Harbor a week before I got on, there were little groups of people in their little pirate costumes. But we really try to focus on being merchantmen, honest merchantmen. But I did tell the kids quietly, you know, we're only pirates when we need to be. But of course, we're honest merchants, aye, aye. That was kind of fun. It made it easy to engage with the kids, you know, because they definitely were doing a lot of, are you a pirate? Are you a pirate? No, no, I'm not. And between that and the parents wanting to know more technical information about the ship, there was a lot of technical information questions about the ship, because it is all steel and iron built in a replica. But if you look at it, you have to like, is that really a wood?
So besides Fowleys, were there any other slang that you picked up?
Sailor language is all a different language. When you're on the boat, you don't say right. You don't say left. You don't say front. You don't say back. You say bow, aft, starboard, and port. And I will admit there were a few times when I really meant my other port or my other starboard. And you know, you get away with that as the first day volunteer. But in the real world, those kind of issues would be intolerable.
It could be a serious issue.
When you get blindsided from one side because you shouted at the large freighter that didn't note you on the radar was really coming from another side. You know, there's a lot of responsibility when you're crewing a boat. And unfortunately, we have news this week of another ship disaster that shows just how hazardous it is for even a modern vessel with a large crew. We are this 65-foot catch out in the middle of the ocean where nobody's going to come out and hook a line on us like AAA. The closest harbor one way would be Bodega Bay. The next harbor is Fort Bragg. And at 0:30 in the morning, if you have an issue, you really are you have to depend on your shipmates to resolve it. And also basically make sure that the passengers are remain safe. It was huge sitting out on deck at 12 to 4 a.m. checking the bilges and make sure there's no extra water and reading all the instruments and making sure the pyros, there's new instruments, you know, the pyros that are checking the exhaust temperature to make sure the engines are running together, the diesels are running together. It would have been nice to sail up the coast, but the winds blow the wrong way, especially to Point Arena. So it is much easier just to turn the keys on the diesels and point north. Coming south, they sail.
So would you do this experience again?
Absolutely. In fact, I have to pull another week anyway so I can get my official paper so that the next time I can do it, the next time I pull a 14-hour day that includes all the dishes that the crew and passengers don't do, I'll explain that in a minute, you know, I can get that pittance, you know, because they don't make a lot of money either. They do this mainly for love. This is something that you can tell that they appreciate doing. Nobody whines. It's an unusual situation. It's not like a job where your boss gives you some duty and you're like, yeah, I don't want to do that. Sorry. That thought never came into my mind when, up until the point where they said not only on galley duty, the one duty that just really, that they didn't tell me about to the end was you have to stay on the ship and sober. Now,
what?
Yeah, what? I've been here for 14 hours. I want to go up to this place and have a cold one. Nope. And so I by that time, we'd all had some bug, little light bug, you know, that had been, some people had cold, some people had gotten a little ill in port. There was a lot of kids. I was on an edge for a moment. But I got my rest, got up in the morning, it was all good. But I wanted to have a beer. And we had brought our own 12-pack down the hill from Fort Bragg. So we had some cold premium brews in the fridge.
And all you could do was look at it.
I really didn't even look at it. I just did my dishes and got into my my solitaire on my computer in my bunk until I had to turn the generators off.
Well, since you spent time as a volunteer, you pretty much knew the ship both ends, front and back and left and right. So if for somebody who hasn't been on the ship before, is there a little insider tip of what to look for or what questions to ask that maybe it wouldn't occur to them?
I think it's about preparation and being an old Boy Scout. Be prepared is my core still in everything I do. And I think if you're ever going to go on one of these ships as a passenger or a volunteer, as a crew, or everybody up there was like, oh, I'd love to work on a ship like that. Be prepared to understand it's not a democracy when you're on a boat. You know, it's more of like a dictatorship, a benevolent dictatorship.
Like the military.
And if they say jump, you don't even ask how high. You just jump as high as you can. So even as a passenger, those passengers, they were, of course, a lot of them were from the region, so, and a lot of them had sailing experience. So they were in the groove from the beginning. But, you know, you got to do things smart. It's the ocean. If you think you're going to get sick, take the little pills beforehand so they have a chance to work. It's going to be rough out. Be prepared with the right gear. It's layers and something waterproof. And don't go load up just because you normally eat at a buffet. Treat your stomach right because it never tastes better coming up the second time. And understand that you're not going to have some kind of private suite on a small boat. You're going to be bunking with passengers. The age, to give you an idea, in the main hold, I'd say that the age range was 21 to 70. Men and women, mix of passengers and crew. And the oldest were passengers. So there was a Norwegian woman who had worked on the Merchant Marines for Norway. She's down there. There's just no privacy per se. And the facilities are kind of unique on a boat.
I.e.
you can serve water. You can serve both gray and black water storage, so you don't get sloppy. You are always cognizant of everybody else. You know, for example, at dish time, they say you do your dish plus one. Now, the galley cleans up way more than everybody else, but when you do your dishes, you clean and you grab one. So when you do the plus one, you got to do the dishes right and you do them fast and you get out of the way. You definitely have to always be aware of where you're at, because if you slip, and let's say we're MOB or man overboard, you endanger the whole ship, especially if it's under sail, because turning a ship under sail around is different than just slamming the throttles forward and backwards and causing the boat to spin and spinning the wheel to one direction, how you do with the boat with a twin screw like the Hawaiian Chieftain is. Jibbing over, that's a whole different ball of wax, you know. If you're the man overboard under sail, people have to climb up the riggings and start loosing lines to cause the boat to turn around. It's not like a car. And even when you steer a boat on the ocean, you know, probably in trouble calling it steering a boat on the ocean, you aren't on the highway. You're on this flexible platform of navigation called the ocean, where waves could be coming from multiple directions at the same time. The wind could be spinning in front of you 1 minute and decide it's going to go left behind you the next. So it's a situation where if you maintain a high level of self-responsibility, it helps be that percentage that goes to make sure everybody in the ship is safe. Everybody, including passengers, had some hand in the overall safety of the ship. Does that make any sense?
Of course. You're all in the same source of energy. You, one person turns one way, it affects everybody else, like the beatings of the butterfly wings.
Or
only a smaller, very small hive.
Well, when you think about it, you know, when people say we're all in the same boat.
Literally, yeah.
It really hits home when you are in a boat where if you reach over the side, you can stick your hand in the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
But if a rogue wave came from the other side, or just a robust one, interesting fact that they shared. Most people that are recovered, that don't survive, the Coast Guard says they were doing something over the side of the boat that they figured was convenient.
Mm.
Okay, and they normally have to do with functions of the human body, or because they were sick. And the very first thing they said is, if you're going to get sick, just get sick on the deck. The waves will wash it over. It's much better than getting pitched overside over the side of the boat because you thought you should get sick over the side of the boat. You can always rinse off the deck.
I learned that in a rowboat when I was a kid. Grade school, campfire girls. We were all on one side of the rowboat trying to look at a fish in these very clear waters in a lake. And next thing you know, capsized. So you only have to have that experience once.
Mm-hmm.
Every ship, boat, vessel you go on after that, that's in the back of your mind. You see everybody going to one side. We're going to tip over. No, we're not. It's like,
well, you know, people think a ship like the Hawaiian Chieftain, which I think was 100 tons, 100 foot from bowsprit, which is that long pointy thing on the edge of the ship, to the aft. They think a ship like that is somehow invulnerable to the ocean. I mean, it should just, man, it's planted in the ocean. It goes where it wants, especially with those two diesels, but it's not the case. I used to drive lots of little sailboats on rivers, you know, sailing like what they call lightning class in the Mississippi River and in inland lakes and even Lake Tahoe. And they just seem so not relevant to sailing now after being on the Hawaiian Chieftain. Fun, but nothing like what you would experience on a boat like this where, you know, first of all, this is the ocean. This is real. This is not a game. You know, it's fun. It's cool. Great moments, but...
Well, I was referring more to the awareness of balance.
Oh, the... Okay.
More the awareness of physics, you know.
Well, oh, that's where I was trying to go. This boat, even with 16, 17 souls on board, those people on the boat can affect how it navigates. Just that many. They're not going to cause it to tip over like a rowboat.
Right.
But it's like moving little weights over one side of the boat to the other. It's hard enough to make that boat go straight. If you had watched me from a radar on the helm, you would have said, that boy has had a drink. Because keeping the boat going straight against the currents and the waves and the wind, you know, I basically was zigzagging up the Sonoma coast. You know? Because, you know, you go one way and then as you get the boat going your way, you have to overcorrect just a little bit and bring it back. Because the waves were, you know, that's the downside of its design. It's liable to get pitched and tossed by the sea.
Because it's obviously a replica and you have modern technology on there. Being at the helm, knowing if you're going straight or not, did you have some kind of little meter or gauge that you were watching so you knew if you were zigzagging?
Yeah, there's a lot of things to watch. First, you have the compass, which is a huge compass right in front of you. Then you have a GPS. Then you have some radio tracking stuff that plots data. And then you have a rudder indicator because you can't see necessarily where the rudder is from where the helm is positioned. So you actually are watching all this stuff. And if your rudder is way over one side and you're getting ready to make your mark, you know, well, guess what? I'm going to be weaving until I weave this boat straight. You know, we're kind of going to get into the rhythm. And, you know, you're like, left, no. I mean, did I say it? Port, no. To the starboard. And I basically opted to do the engine checks on the night watch, because not only could I not make out the course on the compass, especially from the distance you'd normally have to be, but I couldn't get the steering behind my wheel, behind my back done. And the guys and the girls that have done this for a while, they can stand in front of the helm so that they're closer to the compass, and they know how the boat feels. So they were with the hand behind themselves, you know, just tooling along. And I was like, no, you know.
Like riding a motorcycle, you just get to feel and you become one.
Right, with it. And I wasn't there yet. My watch was led by a captain in training named Patty. She was really supportive. And I said, you know, Patty, you should be at the helm. Let me go count belts and check the bilges. And that's the only place where I thought I was going to get sick, because you lose your point of reference. Going down into this 120-degree room that's loud and hot, going down in there and crawling on your knees with a flashlight to look underneath the engines for any extra water. You know, like, that's about the only time I thought I might get sick, but I survived.
The belly of the beast.
The belly. And there's multiple bellies, 7 holes you check, and they're all in different compartments.
Another way to work off a couple engines.
I think I did. I was feeling pretty petite for my size, which is kind of like a joke.
So what do they have available on board for eating fare?
We eat well.
Okay.
We had to, you don't mind I'm dropping names, Lilia, the cook, who she worked magics in that kitchen. Most people that came aboard touring the ship would look in the galley, I call it the kitchen, zap me, and they said, wow, what a cute little galley, but it's designed so that you can stand in the middle and cook. And she always served on time. We had pancakes, French toast, scrambled eggs, sausage, turkey sausage, and then meals. She also had a vegan meal every time and a gluten-free meal every time. One person, she did it all. She did a really nice pork roast for one dinner. They had red beans and rice. We ate well, you know, and then there's food just left out. So it's like the kitchen never closes, because you may need a snack to keep your energy up. So, you know.
Well, that makes sense.
Yeah, so, you know, the kitchen never closes. They always have plenty of snacks. The leftovers are left out where you can get at them. You just are diligent. You know, you don't leave your dish in the sink. Once you're done, you go in there, wash it up. If there's another one there, you wash it. You deal with it. This was an overwhelming experience, but
still processing. Probably.
Yeah, this was high adventure to me. You know, I do a lot of road trips and stuff, and this was out there. It was very cool. Between the hard work, there was hard work, thrills, scared out of your drawers thrills, and then the warming involvement in the community of Noyo Harbor, Fort Bragg, the social aspect. Being a happily married guy, when I got off the boat, I did have fleeting thoughts of, oh, I'm a sailor in a new port, you know. Just, you know, I knew when I was going to the bar, you know, I'm a sailor in a new port. And I, of course, was respectful of that. But I tried to imagine what it's like. You know, I'm probably going to drop the ball on this. It's like being an explorer to me, you know, where you're going, where every moment is someplace you've never been before, even if you've been there before. No wave is the same. No fog bank is the same. No yank on a rope is the same. And my muscles on one side of my body will never be the same either, from learning how to do what they call sweat a rope. Let me tell you. You're going to go on a boat and you're going to work even as a passenger and have fun on them windjammer cruises. Stretch. Do a lot of lateral stuff where you pull down on weights. Imagine you're pulling ropes that will pull you.
Well, thank you, Master Commander. Look forward to hearing about future adventures of yours.
Just call me Deckhand Number 10.
Okay. Thank you, Number 10.
You can read and view photos of John Wood's adventure at Woodman, WUDMAN.com. In my ongoing celebration of the 150th anniversary of the National Park System, I'm heading over to Alabama, to the Tuskegee Airmen National Site, located at Moton Field Municipal Airport, east of Montgomery. Moton Field was the only primary flight training facility for African-American pilot candidates in the U.S. Army Air Corps, Army Air Forces, during World War II. Graduates were provided advanced training at Tuskegee Army Airfield, which is a private airfield today. For decades, Black men in the United States wanted to fight for and defend their country, but racial prejudice was so strong they weren't allowed in military forces. It was actually believed they weren't intelligent enough. Civil rights groups successfully applied the pressure required to allow the Black men to serve. The Tuskegee Airmen of the 332nd Fighter Group and 477th Bombardment Group were trained at Tuskegee Army Airfield at Tuskegee University, which was founded by Booker T. Washington. More than 1,000 black pilots trained between 1941 and 1946. Honors awarded to the Tuskegee Airmen included Distinguished Flying Crosses, Legions of Merit, Silver Stars, Purple Hearts, and the Croix de Guerre. In 1945, a Distinguished Unit Citation was awarded to the 332nd Fighter Group for outstanding performance and extraordinary heroism. At the National Site, you can visit the Hangar No. 1 Museum, which includes the Orientation Room, which offers a 4-minute video introducing the Tuskegee Airmen, who they were, and the various jobs they performed. The museum area houses two World War II-era training aircraft and a recreation of some of the sights and sounds of Moton Field during its heyday. A scenic overlook allows you to enjoy a view of the historic core, original 1940s buildings. This recent Memorial Day weekend, it hosted the Tuskegee Airmen Fly-In, sponsored by Negro Airmen International and the City of Tuskegee, and will also host the annual Labor Day Fly-In, to be sponsored by the Black Pilots of America on the weekend preceding Labor Day. There will be flyovers, vintage aircraft, military and civilian aircraft displays. By the way, Daniel Chappie James became the first African-American 4-star general in the U.S. Armed Forces. He was a Tuskegee Airman. This weekend is all about enjoying and preserving natural environments. I love it. Saturday, June 7th is National Trails Day. And as you know, I'm an avid hiker, so I encourage you to take part. Walking and hiking are healthy and healing on many levels, and there are trails available for all ages and abilities. Yes, there are even wheelchair-friendly trails. And trails aren't limited to pedestrians. Horse trails and bike trails are also celebrated. In 1968, President Lyndon B. Johnson signed the National Trails System Act, establishing national recreation, scenic, and historic trails. Today, National Trails Day is celebrated not only in all 50 states, including Alabama, which offers at least 12, but also Canada and Puerto Rico. Celebrate the day by traversing a trail, walking, hiking, running, or dedicating a new trail. Or look for an organized event near you by visiting AmericanHiking.org/NTD-events. One of my family's trail exploration ventures went terribly wrong when I was about 10 years old. My dad suggested we follow a deer trail to see where the deer were going. One brother, who was in the lead, stepped into some kind of bee's nest. Next thing we know, he's screaming in pain. My other brother starts crying because he sees one of the bees flying over our brother's head. And my dad is yelling, "Why the hell are you crying?" My mom angrily responding, "They're getting stung, Ronald!" No, I have not been on a deer trail since. Sunday, June 8th, World's Oceans Day, celebrating and protecting our oceans and life within them. WorldsOceanDay.org lists events around the globe and suggestions on how you can help to not only mark the day, but also raise awareness, especially if you have children. Educating them and spending ocean family time builds powerful foundations of appreciation and creates stewards of our planet's natural resources and respect for all life. There's an interesting website you might want to check out, ParanormalOcean.com, which talks about the mysteries of our planet's oceans. Another childhood memory. My family's visiting cousins at Santa Cruz, California. We're all sitting and lying around on the beach while my grandfather, my mother's father, was out quite a ways playing in the surf. He waves. Mom tells us to wave back. He waves some more. We wave back some more. His waving becomes more aggressive. My mother realizes he's trying to communicate something and suddenly starts laughing. "Dad lost his trunks!" She hands a towel to my dad and asked him to take it out to my grandfather. Turns out an ocean wave had crashed on him so violently it pulled his trunks right off. There's a photo in a family album of Grampy standing in the water waving with my mother's handwritten caption, "The day Dad lost his trunks." Do something different. Read book reviews by children. Visit theguardian.com/children's-books-site.